Welcome to Seeds, a show where we talk with people who are living lives of purpose and doing amazing things that make a positive impact in our world. We take time to listen to them as they reflect on their life journeys and what has shaped them into who they are today and what motivates them to be involved in what they do. Well, kia ora, everyone. Welcome along to Seeds Podcast. This is Stephen Moe, and I'm really glad you could join me because I got the chance to have an interesting conversation about Reefton, which is a town on the west coast of the South Island. And the person to tell me about that was Patsy Bass. And I really enjoyed learning from her about the community there, the regeneration that's happened, and also the business that she was involved in founding, the Reefton Gin Distillery Co. I think you're going to enjoy this episode because we talk about a lot of different topics, and those are my favorite ones. If you do like it, then why not check out some of the other interviews in the back catalog, because there's more than 380 of those. And a quick shout out to Joy Reed from One Mother to Another, because it was through attending her fundraising event and putting up the auction of a Seeds Podcast interview that I got the chance to meet Patsy, and I really enjoyed this conversation. Now let's get into this corredor with Patsy. So it's a real pleasure to welcome Patsy Bass, who's the founder and chief executive of the Reefton Distilling Co. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Great to meet you, Stephen.
So I'm looking forward to finding out about the company and, you know, what you're doing and what are the products and where you're based. Because, I actually love the West Coast and that part of New Zealand. But before we do that, I'd like to go back in time. So could we start with you telling us a bit about what was life like when you were, say, 5 or 6 years old?
Goodness, that's interesting. So I was born on the West Coast in a wee town called Reefton, and just before I started school, we moved across to Christchurch. My mother didn't want the boys following Dad into the coal mines, and so we moved across, and so we were probably having quite a time adjusting from being, you know, heading off on horses and push bikes and disappearing for the day in a small community that was really safe, to moving to the city and, you know, parents doing different work here and being incredibly homesick. And so even though we were settling into Christchurch, we went back to Reefton every school holidays, every long weekend, and just about every second weekend in between until I was a teenager.
Wow.
So I still feel like I grew up on the West Coast, so we were still doing those things.
Yeah.
And once we actually stopped going back as frequently, I started to become a bit of a rat bag because I didn't know what to do with my time hanging around on the streets, getting, you know, just not having all the activities that we did on the coast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just for people listening, because we get people listening from around the world as well as here in New Zealand, can you describe, like, where is Reefton for people to know, and how many people are we talking about when you were growing up?
Like, okay.
This is a relatively small place, right?
Yeah, so Reefton is a speck of a place on the west coast, and it's nestled in the middle of New Zealand's largest forest estate, so over 2,000 square kilometres of thick, lush rainforest. And it rains a lot there. We measure our rainfall in metres, not millimetres, but most of that is in the night time, and you listen to it bashing down on your tin roof. It's over on the west coast of the South Island. And we have beautiful long hot summers, and I go back there now and it hasn't changed from the 1960s. You know, all the locals are swimming in the river behind the main street. Everyone knows each other. It's an incredibly safe wee town.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a great wee spot. There's only 32,000 people scattered along a 600 and something kilometre coastline. So, yeah, very sparsely populated region.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly beautiful place. I have an accent, but I actually grew up in Christchurch. So I love going gold fossicking.
Mm.
So that area.
Yeah, the place.
That's, yeah, it's kind of the start from Reefton over. There's lots of places to go with gold pans and things. Mm. There's dock designated areas, and Reefton is always a place that we would stop and we would get out and we'd have some food, you know, and then go and camp and do the different things. So I know where you're talking about.
Oh, that's fantastic. And look, yeah, there are a lot of people that fossick, and gold has had a resurgence. All the mines are opening up again. There's another gold rush happening on the coast now.
Yeah. Mm. And just talk about your father and your mother a little bit. I'm curious, because coal mining, like,
yes,
that's a really hard job, isn't it? Going down deep and underground. Is that what he was doing?
And thank you for asking. I mean, I lost my parents over 20 years ago. It's so nice to actually even think about them, which I do a lot when I live on the coast. So Dad was in the Royal Navy in the UK in World War II. And he came out to New Zealand as a 10-pound POM, they called them. So 10-pound passage, came out here to work in the coal mines. When he was terminally ill, I asked him if he was scared, and he said, not of this. He wasn't scared in the war, but he said he was scared every day that he went down into those mines, and yet he did that to feed his family. So I admire him enormously for that. And he was living in the single man's camp in Reefton, and on the other side of that, next door, was my mother's house, and so as a 16-year-old, she worked in the kitchens there, and that was how they met. So he rode her horse into the kitchen one day and obviously had fancied her, and so, yeah, that was sort of where we started in Reefton.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like just thinking about job types and the work that would involve to go down underground, because we're talking...
Pitch black.
Yeah.
I remember one day my brother taking me to one of Dad's mines, and I stood at the entrance and looked down, and I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and it was where he used to work, and you could only see so far, and then it was black. And I can remember even as a kid thinking, imagine going in there. I can remember as a child watching Mum wrap Dad's crib, his lunchbox, up in his black singlet that he took to work each day. And I said to her, why does Dad have such a big lunch? And she said, well, if there's an explosion or a cave-in at the mine, he needs to have a few days' food with him. And it was all very matter of fact. And I thought, oh, okay. But the enormity of that sank in later on as an adult. And you think, imagine going to work every day thinking something like that could happen.
Yeah. Well, it's the definition of claustrophobia, isn't it? Like, you're
absolutely
down deep underground, it's dark. Yeah.
And I don't think many people survive those situations. So, yeah, there was that as well.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about your mother.
Okay. So, Mum, her family had been generations on the West Coast. And so, very much small town Reefton girl, loved it there. She worked in the kitchen at the single man's camp as a kid, but I think married young, had 5 children, and so didn't have a career, and started working later on in life when she was in Christchurch.
Mm-hmm.
Came from a large family, proud West Coasters. My brothers ended up going back there to raise their children. So it's a place that's very much in our DNA.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's the West Coast as well, I think. So I work for this law firm called Perry Field. We have an office in Hokitika. I see quite a lot of what's happening in the Hokitika office. And it feels like the West Coast is a place where if you're born in the West Coast, then you're a West Coaster. But if you moved there when you were, say, 15, you'll never become a West Coaster. You know what I mean?
I think
a part of that.
I think we're softening a little bit now because it's been through hard times, and I think we're really appreciative of people that come there and make it their home and contribute to the region.
Yep.
So, it was when I was being interviewed for our business a few years ago that I realised I've grown up, even though I left as a 4-year-old, grown up as a coaster living in Canterbury. I've never felt like a Christchurch girl that happened to be born on the West Coast.
Right.
And that was quite a profound moment for me when that sort of just clicked and I realised that.
Yeah, but it's special that you have that sense of identity, because a lot of people these days are feeling a bit displaced, like, where am I from? Who am I? But you've got a sort of a solid foundation there.
Yeah, and I think I was fortunate. I spent, I think, about 7 years working for Te Runanga o Ngāitahu here. And so that, you know, that place and that intergenerational thinking and that is one of the things that I've carried with me from that. It was a fantastic opportunity as a New Zealander.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So you mentioned there was a time when you weren't going back as often.
Mm.
Did you still have that sense of, like, I'm from Reefton, or did it start to fade away?
No, I think that faded. I was probably somewhere 14, 15, and I think we had perhaps gone back less. Mum and Dad had bought their own business. They were really busy here. All the other kids had left home, and it was just me. And so that was where I think I got a bit disconnected with that and went off the rails. I was an absolute scamp for about 10 years before I kind of grew up, had my own daughter, and wanted to give her a better life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Oh, that's interesting. And so Reefton, like, it seems like that's the center of gravity in your life.
Mm.
When did it start calling you, or when did you start realizing you wanted to move
back? So when I had my own daughter, she was probably 2 or 3, and I started going back with mum and dad so that she was milking cows on farms by hand and just, you know, understanding where food came from.
Mm.
And we just, yeah, we sort of started to go back from then. So it was a small moment in my life of disconnection, really, and then I got grounded again.
Yeah. And what's the feeling that you get, you know, because you spend quite a lot of time here in Christchurch and Canterbury. Is there a place as you're driving over, is it through the Lewis Pass that you go? Is that where you
I love you your questions, yes. So we go back over the Lewis Pass, and that moment for me happens as I turn off at Springs Junction.
Okay.
So there's all the traffic, carries on up to Murchison, Nelson, and when you turn off, the traffic quietens and you drive through the Rahu Saddle, which is some of the best driving in the world, and I just relax into everything. Everything slows down for me and I'm home.
Mm.
So that's that 35, 40-minute drive to Reefton from there.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I know that area relatively well because one of my favorite parts, probably my favorite place in the world, is Lake Daniels, which as you're driving up, you know it, right?
Yes,
so
well.
You turn off to the right there and then you can walk up probably 7 or 8 kilometers, I think, to Lake Daniels. But that's quite near this junction that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So, it's just before that, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a beautiful area. But I love that sense that you can be in a place and you relax into who you are, like who you truly are. And it sounds like it's that drive that does it for you.
It does.
Yeah. Oh, great. So tell me a little bit about then, I guess, going back to Reefton and life there. And yeah, what happened next?
Yeah, so my husband and I were sort of semi-retired. I was self-employed, working 3 or 4 days a week. And I was a bit despondent. I'd go back to town and it just felt like it was getting tireder and there was less available there. And I thought, you know, my aunties and uncles were into their 80s and starting to pass away. And I thought, what will happen when those old sort of institutions of town aren't here anymore? And so many of the young people have travelled away for work that I didn't want it to become a sort of transient falling apart town.
Mm.
And I said to my husband, you know, we should come back here. We should roll our sleeves up and do something really well to help part of the revitalisation of the town. And a chap had just moved there, John Bowsian, who had he was a co-founder of DressMart. And he went because he identified that there was a feeling in the community that you don't get very often. And so he started to buy property there, restore it. And I went back to town this day and it felt like it had had a coat of paint. Like there were more lawns mowed and it felt more vibrant. So I had a coffee with this chap and went back and did a 3-month contract with him. And I said to my husband, this is it, you know, it's time to go home.
Mm.
And so we thought, let's give it 2 years. It will work or it won't work. But it was the best thing we could have done.
Wow.
Like it is, even though I have to spend a lot of time in Christchurch and travelling around New Zealand and overseas for work, that's my place still.
Yeah. Well, I think it sounds like that's the Turanga Waiwai, right? Like your home, you know, where your home when you're there. What year did you go back and have that 3-month contract?
2016 or 17, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And I've got a 1-year-old granddaughter now, so, you know, I want her to know the West Coast.
Yeah.
So have a place that she can visit and understand.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And tell me about that individual, the one who owned DressMart.
John.
John,
yes.
Yeah, tell me about John. What was it? Did he have some connection to the city or the town? Or
no,
he just thought, this is something I want to do?
Him and his partner had sold Castle Hill Station and he thought, I need to live somewhere. And he saw a property for sale there. And he ended up buying that and he just spent more time in the town, loved it, so bought more property. So it's very much his home. He's actually engaged to one of my friends there that's got a business in town as well. So he's put down his roots there.
Right, so you've welcomed him in.
Well, he was there before me this time, but he's been a huge part of the community. He was a councillor for a while there. You know, has been instrumental in beautifying parts of the town and getting sort of public walkways tidied up and things.
Mm. I probably won't ask this question the right way, but yes. Bear with me. What to what extent, you know, you're talking about the community, mm-hmm. it's a very intangible thing. It's hard to put your finger on it and say what it is. But then we're talking about the lawns are mowed and the houses have been done up, or, you know, there's a spirit of something different that's physical change.
Mm.
How do those things interact, do you think, between the spirit of a place and the physical environment that the people are in?
So what highlights the sense of community for me there is it's very much the people, and there are the people that have been there for generations, and, you know, it's great that they're still there. And then there's the new people that come in and bring new skills and businesses and innovation. But if you go for a walk early in the morning in Reefton, you come across a crisscross of people. And when you say, oh, what are you up to? It's like, oh, well, Betty's got cancer now, so I'm going round to get her up. Or Bob's not well, so he's just out of hospital. I'm going round to give him his breakfast. That's the community. Mm. Like, my sister is in her 70s, one of them now, and she lives in Christchurch. She's so homesick. She should have gone back decades ago, but she's stayed in Christchurch. And she said, oh, no, I need to be near a hospital now because of my age. She's fine. She's fit and healthy. And I said to her, you'd get better care in Reefton from the community than you will in a hospital or a retirement village in Christchurch.
Yeah. I really like those observations because it points to something that we're missing quite often in a bigger city, which is individual.
Yeah, working full time, no time to know your neighbours.
And the fact that you would know that Bob is sick or that Lucy fell down or that somebody needs some support and help and that you'd come alongside them.
Yes.
Yeah, it's something we're missing.
Yeah,
and the physical environment, how does that help, do you think? How does it reinforce? Because it's like a positive loop, I bet.
So I talk about gutsy West Coasters. So it is a tough environment. Like back in the day, it can be bleak. It's sort of extraction industries, hard on the body, and you need to be resilient. You're in a lush rainforest. Everywhere you look, there's a hill of this, you know, beautiful native forest. And then you've got the river running through. You've got this abundant rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's a heritage town, Reefton, so it's that built environment that's been restored now. So there's that history, but there's also that sense now of the modern, you know, the sort of what we're doing for the next 150 years.
Yeah.
Has that answered your question?
I think so. It definitely helps to get that picture. I was listening to a podcast from somebody who was talking about architecture and the fact that if you look at homes where the poorest people live in a city, very often they're closed in, there's not much light, there's not much beauty in terms of trees and grassy areas, and therefore the children are growing up in this environment, a built environment, without the ability, you know, to see the blue sky in the way that you would if you lived out in the country. And I think there's something to that, like, where you are, the physical environment also has something that seeps through into your soul or your spirit at a deeper level as well.
Yes, and, you know, you still see kids bareback horses riding down the main street of town and doing those things we did in the 60s and 70s. And I quite like that in such a technological age that, you know, that kids are out doing that. You know, they're heading out on bike rides for the day, getting up to all sorts of mischief.
And having done a little bit of gold fossicking and things, I know that the streams are quite often like a tea-coloured water, aren't they?
That's beach stains from the leaves of the trees.
Yeah.
But very pure, beautiful water, but it's just got, some of it has those tannins.
No, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. So tell me a little bit about your initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd moved back there, you're looking at the town, you're thinking about the future. Tell me about the Reefton Distilling Co.
Yes. Well, look, just before we moved back, it was like, what would we do to contribute to the town? So we knew all my life I have wanted to make the West Coast rain sexy, because when you tell somebody that you're from the West Coast, the first thing they just about always say is, it always bloody rains on the West Coast. I find the rain invigorating. The heavier it is, the more likely I'll be out running or walking in it. I just, it just refreshes me.
Yeah.
I will leave work and say, I'm off, because it's bucketing down and bouncing up to waist height. So I didn't understand why people saw that as a negative. And I had a university lecturer who said to me, he came back from Asia and he said, one day the world will be at war over water. And I thought, well, I know where I'd like to live if you're, you know, water's a scarce resource.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided we wanted to go back. So I spent that 3 months there on contract, and I stood in the main street and I talked to people, visitors and locals, and I said, why are you here? What do you like? What don't you like? What would you like to see? And we held community forums that the local community came along to. And out of that, there were about a handful of business ideas. One of them was a distillery. And as a non-drinker, I thought, well, I'm not interested in that. And I parked it and I wanted to do something sexy with gold or whatever. And everything kept pointing, the rain, the botanicals, it all kept pointing back to a distillery. So I thought, I'll do a business case and I'll prove that that's not what we should be doing. And I did the business case and I talked to a person who was ex-industry, and I thought, actually, this is the thing that we should be doing.
Wow.
So I did a complete 180. And yeah, so we moved back and it just took off. Like, yeah, before I knew it, we were opening. We'd been so busy that at about 9 o'clock at night, the night before we opened, I sat there and I sort of looked up, and for the first time I said to my husband, what if nobody comes? I was so focused on what we were doing and making it happen,
yeah,
that I thought, crikey. But we needn't have worried. The next morning there were queues down the footpath and media and that waiting there. And we had 8 staff on that day, and the till rang and people laughed and reconnected, and people, ex-coasters came from all around the country to be there on opening day.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
It was incredible. We had 2 really old gentlemen there, who, one was sitting at the bar, another one walked in, and he turned around and looked at this chap, and they just went, oh my goodness, we used to sit together in the primary school and hadn't seen each other since. And so they sat there and had a little taste of gin and reconnected.
Wow, that sounds like it was quite a day.
Yeah, it was.
When was that?
That was in October 2018 we opened.
Okay.
So we're into our 6th year now.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. And so you're a non-drinker but doing a distillery. How did you upskill and learn about what it would involve?
So I never intended to be the distiller. So I've learned how to distill, but we have staff that do that for us.
Sure.
So one of the things people said to me was, where will you get good staff on the West Coast? And I thought, wow, because, you know, there are amazing skills on the coast, especially with the mines, the engineers and that. And so I popped an ad on social media, and within minutes I got the perfect CV from a young Anapui lad that had grown up on the coast. He was a botanist, Otago University graduate, and he said, this is my dream job, I've been following what you're doing. And he came back early from his OE to be our first distiller.
Wow.
So we got some people and they taught him within 1 or 2 days he was away, and he created a world-class gin.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So I'm curious. I don't know what it involves. What is gin? How do you distill it?
Oh.
How does that work?
So, I mean, you can create ethanol, which is the alcohol from all sorts of things, even potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
We have 2. We use our own grain-based spirit that we make on site, and we also buy in some whey byproduct from Fonterra, which is phenomenal, world class. It's really, really good quality, a beautiful, pure spirit. So you can just tip a flavour in. We choose not to do that. We go out for Little Bitty and we forage fresh native botanicals that go into the still immediately before distillation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just attaching beautiful flavours to this ethanol. So, and you use a fixative for that. It's like perfume, because if you didn't, a few months later you'd take the cap off and there'd be no real flavour and aroma left.
Yeah. And how long does it take to do this sort of process?
Gin is quick, and that's why there's a proliferation of New Zealand gin brands at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You can make it one day, proof it down, bottle it, have it out within a few days if you want to.
Right.
Some people will leave it to sit for a couple of weeks before they bottle it.
Yeah.
But whiskey, which we're also doing on the other hand, that's a long game.
Is it?
So that's a big money hungry beast that you keep feeding for years and years until you've got whiskey on shelf.
Okay, yeah. And because I guess wine takes time as well, doesn't it? Like, you have to have it sitting for a while before it's ready.
Yeah, so I'm not a patient person. So, you know, we had one of our Scottish people, specialists that came over and was working with us, and he laughed. He said, this is the worst thing you should have ever gone into, whiskey.
Right.
Because as soon as I put it down, it's like, I can't wait to taste it. And he's like, well, you've got years ahead before you'll actually be having a bottled whiskey.
Yeah. Mm. I guess it would range how long you wait. Is it lots of years?
Or? Yeah, look, there's a couple of years before you can call it a whiskey in New Zealand, to be called a New Zealand whiskey. We'll tease the market, we'll release a 3 and a 5 year. Independent specialists believe that in 6 to 8 years we'll have the equivalent of a 10 years matured scotch.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know, we've just got to wait and see how the maturation process plays out.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. So next time I'm in Riften, what could I see, or what would happen? Would I be able to go and buy some of this product, or yeah?
Yeah, so we've got a cellar door in Riften. So we've got our gin, liqueurs and vodka is available there. And that's one building back from the main street. And then nearly 2 kilometres from there on the edge of town is our 2 hectare site with our big distillery and all our shiny copper stills, and that's where all the manufacturing happens.
Mm. And is there, like, this has been going, this type of making of the spirits has been going on for a long time, right?
Thousands of years.
Yeah. So you're really bringing it into the modern era, like the processes and how it's done.
Yes, I mean, our processes are still traditional,
mm-hmm.
But I guess it's like the wine, the terroir, the botanicals, the water you use. It all contributes to, you know, what the finished product is. In New Zealand, the industry, it was a new industry. When we came into this in 2017, there were about 35 registered gin brands, and now it must be getting 160, 200. It's you know, really ballooned. But most people in New Zealand are still doing the traditional way. You can fully automate a distillery so that you could lie in bed in your pyjamas and push an iPad. But we wanted to create this employment for locals, especially young people, so they didn't have to leave town for a good career and well-paying job unless they chose to.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a very manual distillery, so they learn the craft of distilling, rather than if it was all automated, it's more of a tech job, and if something breaks, you've got to wait for someone to come in, an engineer to come in and fix it.
Mm.
So
That type of thing is interesting to me, because it kind of originated from your talking with the community, what were the potential ideas, and this was one of them. So part of what you're doing is about Riften itself, isn't it? It's instilling a pride and having a business that then employs local people.
Mm.
Is that undercurrent of...
Absolutely. And, you know, we have, you know, sometimes we've had up to 20-odd secondary school students working for us,
mm-hmm.
and every year we lose a wave that go off to university or whatever, but they'll come back and work for us in school holidays. We've got, you know, our first student last year came on as an assistant distiller, so she's learning the craft. Her family's all based there and been there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We've just got our second one, a young chap that was doing work experience. We've sent him off to Outward Bound, so he's on a 3-week course up there at the moment, and he comes back to a full-time permanent job with us too, as a production assistant.
Yeah.
So, and that's the stuff I'll take to my grave. You know, that's the real pride in this. Alcohol, I've learned to get excited about what we're making. I drink our products now.
Yeah.
Our products are a vehicle for social change and, you know, creating this employment and you know, doing those sorts of... Maybe you can tell I was a social worker earlier in my career. so that's a bit different.
Yeah.
People always said to me when I was an HR consultant, you know, do something that you love and you'll never have a job and things like that. But this was really, I wasn't passionate about alcohol, so it's a bit funny to say that it's, but I've learned that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because on this podcast I talk a lot about future of business, and I talk a lot about the idea that you can combine profit and purpose.
Mm.
So in other words, a business shouldn't just be about how many widgets can we make, how much money can we make, how much profit can we return to shareholders.
Mm.
Instead, a new conception of business is, as you've just said, a vehicle for social change through the employment, through the pride in the community, through the other difficult to measure but important attributes.
Yes.
And yeah, so it's interesting to talk because I didn't know where we're going to go with this conversation, but it actually resonates with lots of other interviews I've done as well.
Nice. And yeah. Like, I think smart business now is looking at all of, like, the holistic view rather than just straight profit. Mm-hmm. And you can return significant shareholder wealth by doing that. Mm-hmm. And people like, you know, Brian West at Atik and, mm-hmm. and some of those companies, like, they're doing amazing things. And the new, younger people coming through now, they're looking for that. You know, I've had young people at a conference stand up and say, if I can't look at your website or your social media and understand your social commitment and your environmental commitment, I'm gone in seconds and you'll never get my business.
Mm, yeah, yeah. No, I agree. It's a complete mindset shift, though. If we think, like, we could go back in time, 1987 or something, people didn't think in that same way. So it's definitely been a shift. Brianne was a guest about a year ago, and I was able to talk to her about her early childhood, just same questions I asked you. And it was really interesting hearing what led to what she does today. And I think that's the key, one of the key things of a life is all those influences, you know, your childhood, your parents, Reefton itself, your social work, like, it all adds up to then what do you do today?
Yes. Yeah, no, it all has an impact in some way. And at the time, earlier on, you don't necessarily understand that. But, you know, as an old lady now, I look back and I can see how all those threads have brought me to where I am now.
Yeah.
And it's very satisfying.
Yeah. And you mentioned, like, the overseas markets and mm-hmm. traveling and things. What's been the reception offshore? Do people understand what you're doing? And
yeah, so we are sort of dipping our toe in the Australian market and the UK. We need big marketing budgets to do that and time, which we're not quite there, so we're just taking it gently. But we very proudly last year were the first New Zealand distillery to ever sell whiskey to the Scots. We got a contract with the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, and we send them new make spirit, and we also mature it in cask here for them as well. So that is one of those pinch me moments for a distillery, because they are the pinnacle, and they've selected our new make out of thousands of samples, going, we actually think this is pretty good, we'll take some.
Wow, that's great. What were the attributes of it? They just said, this has got the missing thing?
Well, I mean, they do take a lot of products from around the world, mm-hmm. but it was the quality of the spirit, the purity and clarity of that, and they could tell that it had been well-crafted, and so obviously they need to wait for it to mature, so we send them samples once a year.
Yeah, oh, wonderful. Mm. And what does the future hold?
The future, other than world domination. Look, we will, we're actually looking at a capital raise at the moment for the next stage of growth. Mm-hmm. So there will be a lot more whiskey down. There'll be new bonded warehouses, a beautiful big visitor centre. We're working with a reputable architect here in Christchurch, actually, on that at the moment. Mm-hmm. And, further expansion plans, but ultimately a whole lot more jobs for young people in Reefton.
Mm. Well, that's great. Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you and just reflecting, because I've been to Reefton, so it's really special to hear about the regeneration and, you know, the new people coming and all that community spirit. I think that's awesome. And I loved hearing about your own background as well and, like, what's led you. Like, it's very purposeful what you were doing to go back to start this business. And I think sometimes entrepreneurs are looking for more, how much money can I make? Whereas you were starting with a different foundation, which I think has probably led to the success, which is great to see.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed coming in, Stephen, and meeting you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for joining me. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Patsy. For me, there was lots of different highlights, and I really loved hearing about the journey that she's been on, looking at a specific town and how you actually go about building a sense of community and pride in where you live. If you're traveling in the South Island of New Zealand, make sure you stop in at Reefton and check it out, because there's a lot of character there, and it's a really beautiful place. Until next time, ka kite anō.